I mean, I've always been running from trouble, mainly, but running was like it was sort of like an escape, you know. It felt good to just be in the zone, to be in the moment, and that's what I got from running. Every time I was in a race, I just felt like something clicked, you know. I felt like I was in this sort of Matrix style. I just felt powerful, you know. And I won races, obviously, and that gave me a big ego boost. And in secondary school, I broke the school record. And then the PE teacher said, you know, you should join a club. And from there, I did, and I improved. And then realised that I could actually run in the Paralympics because of my visual impairment. And then, so that's how it kind of started, really.
That was Team Great Britain Paralympic sprinter Solomon Baugh. And this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Catania. I'm your host. This is my show. Around here, I do risk, resilience, and uncertainty, but I like to do so with a twist. I'm of the view that risk and uncertainty are fundamental parts of life. We can't escape from them. But what we can do is learn to embrace risk and uncertainty, to take risk intelligently. And what I do is long-form conversations with fascinating guests who've done exactly that, or they have some interesting views on the risks of the day. We explore risk across all aspects of life. Thank you for being with me. It is highly appreciated. And I've received a couple of questions about the show's frequency. We do long-form conversations at least every 2 weeks. That's what I like to call a full episode. But sometimes, and if you've been following the show, you'll know that very often this is either more frequent than that, or in between episodes, I'll post something called an in-betweenisode. And if that's confusing, just go to allthingsrisk.co.uk and subscribe, and you won't miss a beat. New episodes come out on the Tuesday of the week that they're assigned, and you can find the show on just about any app that has good podcasts. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and a whole host more. The only place where I think we're not on as a podcast is Google Play. Now, the reason for that is podcasts are available on Google Play only in the UK, only in the US and Canada, apologies. And we're a UK-based podcast, and podcasts, I still don't have the ability to put the show onto Google Play. I'm looking for a way around that. So if you have any ideas, just let me know. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to send me that. Right, I'd like to get into today's episode. Today, I have the honor of giving you the youngest guest I've had so far on the show. He's 18-year-old Solomon Baugh. Solomon is a sprinter on the Team GB Paralympic team. Team GB stands for Team Great Britain. In 2015, he won gold at the Paralympic School Games in Rio. That's kind of like a junior Paralympics, and that was in the 100 meters. And he's now aiming to win gold at the 2020 Paralympic Games in Tokyo. But there's a lot more to Solomon than being a sprinter. He was born in Guinea-Conakry. That's in West Africa. That happens to be one of the poorest countries on Earth. And his parents noticed that he had a problem with his vision, but it went undiagnosed. Because as you could perhaps imagine, the facilities just aren't there in Guinea to do that. So his parents decided that it would be ideal to move to Britain where their son can get diagnosed and treated, and that's exactly what they did. They moved when Solomon was 8, and he got diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa. So Solomon can only see from one eye, and that eye is kind of like it's tunnel vision, so he has no peripheral vision in that eye. And that's a condition that will progressively get worse. And Solomon has a very profound, mature, and inspiring attitude towards life. And I think that this comes through in the conversation. We get into what it was like for him to move to the UK. And in particular, learning English and what that experience was like. We get into his visual impairment and some of the myths and misconceptions about visual impairment, and also what not to say to someone who is blind. We get into running, success and performance, the flow state, process versus outcome. We obviously talk about risk. We talk about dealing with injury. And this is a young man who's got a very wide range. So we also get into things like transhumanism and philosophy and politics and also sport and the role that sport plays in young people's lives. And we also talk about intergenerational differences. I think Solomon is someone that you should be following for a while, because I think we'll be hearing more about this young man in the future. So without any further delay, let's go meet Solomon Baugh. Enjoy. Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. Really looking forward to our chat. This is going to be great.
And here too. Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, bit of background to who you are. And I came across you on social media and saw that you're an athlete, Paralympic athlete. You're doing all this stuff. I didn't realize how young you were as well. I thought you're, because you come across as older and wiser than you are. But a little background for my listeners. Who are you? What do you do? And who is Solomon?
Okay. Thank you very much for that, by the way. So I'm Solomon Baugh. I just turned 18 and I'm a junior Paralympic runner for Great Britain. I'm also studying philosophy, politics, maths and PE at Sixth Form College. Mm-hmm. I'm also in the process of trying to set up a community interest company based around sports and helping children and young people see the benefits of sports and how it can impact their lives in a positive way. And also just generally, you know, spreading positivity. You know, I think if you're doing something that you're achieving, it's important to allow people to see what journey you're taking and what inspiration you're feeding off, you know. So I make some YouTube videos and some inspiring tweets, which people really enjoy. So that's
awesome.
Yeah.
And we'll get into all that. There's a lot of really interesting stuff there. I did want to talk about why you're studying some of the things you're studying, but that's we'll get into that a little bit later. But don't. If I forget, please remind me, because it's interesting. Yeah. But you're really interesting guy, confident young man. And I did want to get into. So you were born in Guinea, in Guinea Conakry.
Yeah.
And moved to the UK when you were eight years old.
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about that and your background? Because you have a visual impairment, and I wanted to get into the back. You told it in such a colorful way in one of the interviews that I listened to in preparation for this, and it'd be very interesting for my audience to hear that as well, I think.
Yeah.
So your condition is retinitis pigmentosa.
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. Could you give us a little bit of background to that, when you were diagnosed with that and then moving to the UK?
Absolutely. Yeah. So born in Guinea Conakry, which is in the west of Africa. Mm-hmm. Some people might know it for negative reasons such as Ebola, but I think it's quite a rich country in culture. But I was born there. My parents started seeing early signs of issues. So some things I couldn't see, or if someone was to pull a funny face, I wouldn't, you know, smile as a baby or something like that. And they're like, well, this is strange. Mm. And they took me to the doctor and they said, you know, we think something's wrong with his eyes. Could you, you know, diagnose it or something? Mm. And, you know, due to a lack of medical instruments and things like that, they kind of said, so, you know, we've looked at his eyes and we've concluded that they don't work properly. And my parents were like, duh, we kind of want a, you know, a prognosis or something, or a name of a condition. They were like, well, we're sorry, but, you know, we don't really have the facilities to do that. And I started my, you know, my school, very excited as you would be. I've got my uniform, got my equipment. I go to school, sit in the back of the class, and the teacher writes something on the board. Chalk and blackboard, and I couldn't see it, you know. Everyone else can see it, but obviously because of my visual impairment, I was struggling to read it out. So I put my hand up and they say, sir, I can't really read what's on the board, could you do something about it? And he does this funny voice. He's like, you are a stupid boy, you just don't want to learn, you are trying to disrupt my classroom. I'm like, no sir, seriously, I think I have an eye condition, so I can't read it. He's like, okay, fine, go to the front. If you disrupt me again, I'll kick you out.
Wow.
I was like, okay, fine. So I moved to the front, unpack my, you know, stuff and get ready again to learn, write something on the board. I still can't see it. I'm like, oh, God. So I put my hand up again. I'm like, sir, I still can't see it. And so he's like, oh, get out, you know, get out of my classroom. You don't want to learn. So I go back home. I'm like, and my mom's like, how was your first day? I'm like, it was good. I got kicked out. So that was the story. So, you know, my parents concluded that obviously this wasn't going to work. I wasn't going to get a sufficient education in these conditions. So that was one of the reasons we moved. Another reason was, I think at the time there was a bit of political violence. So a couple of things were going on. So again, safety was on caution. So those were the two main factors that made us move. And then when we actually moved here, I finally got a diagnosis from an ophthalmologist saying, yes, it's RP, retinitis pigmentosa, this is what it means for now and for the future. And then from there, we could start structuring my education, structuring my lifestyle, and kind of, you know, making things work.
Can you explain what that, so this retinitis pigmentosa, can you explain what that is? You can see a little bit, but not, I mean, my understanding is it's sort of a lack of peripheral vision, but I don't know very much about it. So could you just maybe explain to my listeners what that entails? What can you see? What can't you see?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's difficult to describe, but it's sort of like tunnel vision.
Okay.
So you can only see through the central part of your eye. There is no peripheral. So you bump into, you know, door frames, lampposts, people, because you can't see what's on the side. And because it's a degenerative condition, this small hole that you're looking through is generally small anyway, but throughout years and decades, it gets smaller and smaller. So eventually, you're looking for like a sniper, and then even that kind of disappears after a while, so you've got no vision. And on top of that, there's night blindness as well. As you might have discovered today, I can't see in dark conditions. It's sort of like wearing a pair of sunglasses. So everything is extra dim. So in dim conditions, it's extra dim. So those are the two kind of main issues you get with RP.
Okay. So that was diagnosed here. And when you were, I mean, I guess when you were living in Guinea, did people recognize that you had this condition, apart from your teacher who clearly didn't, but your friends and family, did they sort of recognize that, or was it a little bit
not fully, because at the time it was still manageable, so it wasn't as bad as it is now. So daytime I was perfectly fine, apart from things like football, where you know, because you're looking for a small hole, the ball's flying everywhere, you can't really see it. So for some reason they thought it would be a good idea to put me in goal. Looking back, it was kind of stupid to put the blind guy in goal, you know what I mean? I can't see the ball, just put him in goal. But yeah, no, things like that, not playing tennis because I can't see the ball, and yeah, so people were aware of it, but it wasn't as serious as it is.
Okay. So once you moved to the UK, got it diagnosed, and I'm presuming that made it a little bit easier to you know, go to school and live and I don't know. I mean, I you know, Guinea, I've been to Guinea, and you know, they speak French. So if you came over when you were 8 years old, I don't know if you spoke English at the time. Or, I mean, it has to be a pretty big adjustment.
Absolutely.
I'm curious how that was, what that was like.
Yeah, I mean, it was a massive adjustment. But because I rely a lot on my hearing, because my vision isn't that good, I actually picked the language up quite quickly. But the thing that really surprised me was, you know how we have the internal voice inside of us that speaks and tells us, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, da 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 da. That used to be in my native language of Fulani. But as I started to learn English, it my internal voice changed its language as well. And that gave me a massive perspective shift. Like, this voice doesn't really have an innate language. And we kind of transfer our external voice internally. So if you speak English, you're going to think in English. And if you speak in Fulani, you're going to think in Fulani. And not just the language itself, but the structure in which the language is based in. And the morals and the principles and how things are done. So your whole world shifts in a sense. And that's the one thing that kind of struck me from moving to England.
That's pretty profound, actually. Have you seen the movie Arrival?
I don't. I haven't, no.
No, it's about these aliens that come to Earth. And they there's a linguist who goes and tries to decipher their language, and then she gets into how the language connects with, you know, how there's a theory of language that, you know, language relates to how you think, so how these aliens think. It's fascinating stuff. As I was talking there, though, I wanted to get into something else, which is this BBC documentary, Things Not to Say to a Blind Person. Because I just said, have you seen the movie? And you know, I know that you have some vision, but I'm like, oh, shit, should I have asked that question or not? So, so yeah, there's a lot there about language. We'll get into things not to say about to a blind person. But yeah, it's really interesting about language. I was born in Argentina, actually, and my first language was Spanish. And then I moved to North America. My parents were very keen that I didn't get held back a year in school. So I learned English very quickly. But I also forgot my Spanish, and once I learned to read and write, English became my dominant language. So it's interesting how, but I think there was something there about how language makes you think differently.
Absolutely.
So that's a profound insight for someone who's eight years old, who was 8 years old at the time when that was going on.
Yeah.
So you got into you so you started to study, and then did you sort of become a regular, a regular kid? I mean, you sound like a Brit. To be honest, you sound like you lived here all your life. I wouldn't be able to tell that you moved here when you were 8 years old.
Yeah, I mean, there was one incident which I remember very vividly. I think it was about year two, where in primary school we were sitting around a table doing an exercise in a group, and I accidentally said, "How do you draw your name?" Because I was still in the process of learning English. So I said, how do you draw your name to somebody? And then the whole table kind of laughed at me and said, oh, that's not how you say it. You say it's how you write your name. And I think from there, I had kind of a subconscious imprint to never speak English wrong in the fear that I might get laughed at. So I think in a way that helped me learn English quicker because I felt like I was under pressure to not say something wrong. So, and saying that, I've been through three accents as well. So when I originally came, obviously I had the Afro French English accent, and then I lived in Birmingham for about 5 years. So I spoke in a Brummie accent, and now I've moved to Southwest London. Yes. I speak like this.
Yes.
So yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah, very. Very sort of south, a little bit of south. Yeah, Southwest London. But you did that. Teacher accent quite convincingly as well. So it's all very good. Well, just growing up with your with your visual impairment, I mean, what are some of the? I mean, did you get made fun of at times, or were there were your friends accepting? What was the what's that? Do you recall what sticks out, if anything?
I think early on, I had a really good circle of friends. Mm-hmm. Mainly girls, but it was still it was still a circle of friends, yeah. And I felt comfortable, and I made friends with as many people as, you know, as possible. And I think I made my surroundings as comfortable as possible. Mm-hmm. So I avoided conflict, I avoided fighting, I didn't really try any of that. I think my drive to succeed kind of overrided the issues of my visual impairment early, because I was always at the top of the class. I was always winning the races on sports day. So no one could really tell me nothing. Yeah. If that makes sense. So
yeah, when you beat me in 100 meters, then let's talk.
But, exactly. Yeah. So I think that's another thing why I never really ran into any issues.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. Let's get into things not to say to blind people, because it's still relatively early in the conversation, and I don't know that many blind people.
Yeah.
To be fair, so yeah, just that question I asked you. Did you see that movie? That was just something that. So yeah, what are some of the things not to say? I mean, it's a bit of the show, this BBC Three documentary that you were involved in, is a bit of funny show. So it's I suppose it pokes light of some of this stuff. But how did you get involved in that, first of all?
So I think they originally contacted me. They said, you know, we're doing this documentary about blind, you know, illness, and you as being, you know, a blind, well, visually impaired athlete, do you want to partake? I said, yeah, why not? So it was actually very simple. It wasn't like an application or anything. Yeah.
And so what are some of the things not to say to a blind person?
Did you see that movie?
My listeners are not going to let go of that one either.
Exactly.
But,
I think it's anything sight related, so see you later. Like, again, did you see this? And they always say things like, when you tell them, you know, I'm blind or visually impaired, they always say, okay, how many fingers am I holding? That's really frustrating.
Yeah, that's not nice. Yeah.
You know, because you're kind of trying to say, well, prove it. It's like, well, I'm telling you, you know, why do I need to prove? For people that, you know, watch something like Daredevil, they say things like, you know, is your hearing extra heightened? And it's just the stereotype, really, the stereotypes of blindness and what they see, and they think everyone's like that. Do you dream in sound? And for the ones that have got a guide dog, it's like, can your guide dog read bus numbers, and do they know directions and things like that? I think it's based mainly on a lack of information, and that's what the short documentary was trying to do.
Yes.
Was trying to, because people don't interact with visually impaired people a lot, so it was just pushing it out there and saying, most of the things you say, you kind of don't please.
Yeah.
It's patronizing, and you know it's wrong. So
I think most people are very well intentioned. It's just that, as you say, they don't know that many blind people, so they don't know what to say or what not to say, and it's useful to bring that out and you know let people know.
Absolutely.
So I'm gonna put that in the show notes where people can check out that particular documentary. Let's get into running. Let's talk about running. So you're a sprinter. When did you start running?
I mean, I've always been running from trouble mainly, but running was like it was sort of like an escape, you know. It felt good to just be in the zone, to be in the moment, and that's what I got from running. Every time I was in a race, I just felt like something clicked, you know. I felt like I was in this sort of Matrix style. I just felt powerful, you know, and I won races, obviously, and that gave me a big ego boost. And in secondary school, I broke the school record, and then the PE teacher said, you know, you should join a club. And then from there, I did, and I improved, and then realized that I could actually run in the Paralympics because of my visual impairment. And then so that's how it kind of started, really.
So you sprinter, so short short, fast,
yes,
100 meters.
Yeah.
Cool. You started to compete in the Paralympics. You went to, so let's talk about your gold medal in the 2015, was it Paralympic school games?
Yes,
Paralympic school games, which was in Rio. Mm-hmm. What were your expectations when you first of all, how do you get chosen to represent Great Britain in something like that?
I was at the time I was number one for my age group,
mm-hmm,
and this is sort of like a junior version of the Paralympics.
Mm-hmm.
So because I was number one, it was kind of like, can you do the 100 meters?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, actually, I was thinking of quitting athletics because I didn't really see it going anywhere. You know, I was training 3-4 times a week, having muscle soreness, not having time to play on the Xbox. And it's just like an extra added stress. And I thought, like, you know, maybe I should just drop it and find another hobby. And it's one of those things, you know, in the pursuit of your dreams, like just at the minute where you're about to quit, something happens. So, you know, they called me up, they said, you know, we're going to Brazil, do you want to come along? I was like, okay, I'll do that. I wasn't even expecting, you know, to win or anything. I was like, you know, it'd be cool to go to Brazil and, you know, see the sun and whatever happens. You know, I got to the race and I felt very, like, confident. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, why couldn't I win this race? Mm-hmm. You know, I could easily win this race. And I think that might have shifted my mindset and the expectations I had, and obviously racing a race and coming first, and winning the gold medal kind of just gave me a massive perspective shift. Like, this is actually something I could pursue and you know, do something with.
Mm-hmm. Did that happen? Did that perspective shift happen after the gold medal, or was the lead up important in terms of having, you know, a goal to pursue and to train for? And, you know, that sometimes people get structure and ambition just by having that, you know, a goal and the discipline that goes into, you know, putting that goal together. So I'm just curious if that started after Brazil or before it or
I think the significance of the gold medal really, really did it for me, because when I won the gold, which was really surreal, actually, I didn't really take it in until about 2 days later. But it was mainly what people were saying. For example, because I am, you know, an ethnic minority and I do have a disability and I am an immigrant, all these people from these sectors of society were saying, you're an inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it really was like, wow, you know, if I really pursue this and become successful, I am really not just, you know, benefiting by winning, but I'm also giving other people hope and inspiration. And that's where it really became like, it's kind of my purpose. Really, it's kind of something I want to pursue. Yeah. So that's when it really happened, after I got the medal.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm. What was the time that you ran?
11.87, I think.
Wow,
it was.
That's fast.
Yeah, it's okay. And the funny thing is about that,
yeah,
if you have a visual impairment, your brain automatically slows you down.
Really?
So I could run way faster, but because my eyes can't see my surroundings, it automatically slows me down to prevent me from injuring myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. Yeah. There are, and can you explain the categories? Because I understand there's sort of different categories. I once accompanied a blind runner across a 10K course a couple of years ago, and she didn't have any sight, but so she needed the guide. But you, there are the different categories. So for 100 meters, you didn't need a guide, right? Is that correct? So that's I wrote them down somewhere. I've got them here. But there's a category. Is it T13? That's your category.
Yes.
Can you just explain what the different? There's T13, T12, and T11. Is my understanding.
Yeah.
Can you explain the difference?
So T11 is the ones that are most or completely blind. So, and they even put a blindfold on you just to make sure you can't see anything. And for that one, you run with a guide. So you're attached at the arms.
It's got to be some fast guides.
Exactly. My mentor actually is David Brown, who's the world record holder for T11.
Wow.
So we just have conversations and he... yeah, and then T12 is sort of in the middle. So you've got some vision. So you can either choose to have a guide or I think run by yourself, which I think I'll be moving on to quite soon because of my deterioration. And T13 are the ones that can see the most out of the three, but you still have a vision impairment.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that the brain slows you down, but I guess that
yeah,
makes,
it's
that
weird,
makes sense.
Isn't it? It's a subconscious reaction.
But even if not, like 11.87 is...
It's all right.
It's all right. A little more than all right for you know, 99% of the people out there. But
Do you want to put my bag?
Oh, just behind you.
Oh, cool.
What does training involve now? That was 2015 Brazil, and now. I guess you didn't pursue the 2016 Paralympic Games.
No.
So now you're focusing on 2020 Tokyo.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. That'd be a wonderful experience. What goes into achieving that? Like, if you what goes into getting there? First of all, qualifying.
I didn't know how much work there is because I had the same ignorance as most people in the sense, well, if you're just running 100 meters, you run from A to B and then that's all you you train for. You go down the track and you do a couple of hundreds just to practice to start and you're good to go. Hell no. It's like, man, it's like building a building or baking a cake. It's ingredients, it's structure, it's time, it's effort, it's planning. I didn't even know. So where I was used to, you know, going down a track two times a week, warming up, doing a couple of 60 meters, doing a couple of hundreds, 120, 150, 200, just go home. Now it's about not just the physical training. You've got strength and conditioning, which is, you know, work at the gym. You've got things like flexibility, so doing yoga and using foam rollers. You've got nutrition, you know, it's about diet because there are chemical reactions that happen in your body, and if the right ones aren't happening, then you're not going to build the, you know, muscle tissue and things like that. There's psychology, you know, there's the way you think and the way you face your opponents and, you know, the way you prepare for the race. There is hold on, I'm thinking there's so many.
That's quite a big list anyway.
There's just so much more.
I mean, like anything at an elite level, like you're probably, you know, you're competing against people that are already sort of gifted naturally, that, you know, do the physical training and, you know, have the coaching. But it's the, you know, the mental game and the nutritional game as well, where you're just always looking for that edge, aren't you? That's fascinating.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating stuff.
It's,
but there's so 1%. Much that goes into it.
Yeah.
In terms of, so how much are you training nowadays?
Now I'm training about three, four, even five times a week. Yeah.
Okay. And from 11.87 seconds, do you have how much faster do you need to get to qualify?
So. The official qualification time is 11.5, I believe.
Okay.
But I think you also have to be ranked 12th in the world to get selected for the team.
Okay.
But you know what? That's doable.
That's doable.
Very
doable. Yeah. Excellent. I mean, you're what, 18?
I just turned 18.
18, yeah. You said. So you just turned 18. So you're still growing. Like you've got. Quite a lot of potential, I would have thought still, and so why not? 11, yeah, what's that point? Yes, that's 0.3 seconds.
Exactly. It sounds like nothing, but in sprinting,
yeah, it's a lot.
It's so much.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, it would seem to me that you're, you know, you've got that upside. You certainly have the mentality. if you can do it. Let's talk a little bit about the mental game.
Mm.
In terms of sports psychology and psychology in general, what are you working on? What does that training look like for you?
I think for me, it's I actually posted this on Facebook today. I said, faith beyond logic is my new motto, because I think you can look at the evidence and you can look at, you know, the results and the sheets and what people are telling you, but the only way you can move forward is to see beyond that, is to see beyond what the reality is. Mm. And this is where actually it merges with my visual impairment, in the sense, I don't see what's around me, so the vision I have for the future is very clear, because the distractions that are supposed to be, you know, in front of you, like the people that tell you, you know, you can't do it, whatever, that doesn't distract me, because the only focus I have is my internal projection for the future.
Just tune it out.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I'm working on. It's about the 100% faith that you can get to where you want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many names for it. You know, there's the law of attraction. There's, you know, getting in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to focus on. You know, I've experienced it in a couple of events where I've, you know, ran my best,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to hone that. I'm trying to find what is that ingredient, mm-hmm. what is the recipe to get mm-hmm. that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it literally is 80% mental and 20% physical, mm-hmm. because you can be mechanically adapt to run 9 seconds, but if you don't believe it, and you know, you don't, because the belief allows the brain to make those quick fire.
Yes.
Quick fire reactions,
yeah.
And if you don't believe you can do that, then your brain's not gonna go out the blocks, you know, quick enough. So it really is a mental game.
Right. Have you been looking at or thinking about the? I'm curious about this because I have some beliefs on it, but focusing on the process versus focusing on the outcome.
Mm.
And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. But you know, those that say that, you know, if you think about just getting absorbed in the process of getting better, that's the way to go. If you think about just, well, I want this, you know, whatever, this thing, this gold medal, this, you know, this money, this, you know, that becomes this. My martial arts instructor tells a story of an archer who expert archer, and you know, always hits the bullseye, and then, you know, some guy comes along and says, now for every bullseye that you hit, I'll give you, you know, 10 pounds or whatever, instead of 10 out of 10, you know, that drops to 7 out of 10. And the reason why is because the archer is thinking about the money, not thinking about the,
wow.
the process, getting absorbed in that, in what he's doing. And that's what flow is all about. So I don't know if you've if you have some views or thoughts on that, but
absolutely. I think the moment is where everything happens. Mm-hmm. The moment is where you're building. So if you're not focused on what you're building, then it's going to be terrible. If you focus on the future, what you're thinking about is how it's not here already.
Mm.
But how can you get there when you're not focusing on the process of getting there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really have to be absorbed. And, you know, I look at some of the top athletes that ever lived, and, you know, so the Muhammad Ali's, the Conor mm-hmm. McGregor's, the mm-hmm. David Beckham's, it's like they're so focused on that training, that mm-hmm. Session, that nothing else matters.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm trying to incorporate myself as well. You know, instead of thinking about that race I've got in 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
and how I might lose, it's like, well, I've got a race now mm-hmm. and I could perfect this race and perfect this block start right here, right now. And that's what's going to get me to win, not thinking about the race. So I really agree with you. You know, it's about absorbing yourself in the moment and focusing on what you're building and what, you know, how.
That's really cool. And that goes back to your analogy, your focus analogy, and where I suppose having some sort of tunnel vision does benefit. Literally and figuratively as well.
Mm.
It's really interesting stuff. I love that whole performance and psychology and all of that stuff is fascinating to me. And I think it's important, not just in sport, but these are things that translate in, you know, anything that someone does. So
absolutely,
that's really cool. So Tokyo 2020 is, well, it's coming up, you know, just about three years away.
Yeah.
So, it's not far off. How's the training going? How are you feeling? How are you, what's your...
It's going really well. And mm-hmm. what's telling me I'm on track is, a couple of months ago, I was selected to be a part of the talent development squad.
Oh, cool.
For the run up to Tokyo. So cool. That's kind of one thing that's like, okay, so they believe in
excellent.
Me. So,
excellent.
You know, let's keep going on with it. And I'm expecting to drop 0.2 of a second each year. This year I was injured, so I couldn't mm-hmm. I couldn't do that and race as well. But I'm in the process of recovery. And again, injury is a huge wake up call. It's a huge time to reflect and I think it's important in every athlete, you know, you need your injury to really look at the grassroots of what you're doing and where you want to go with it. Time of contemplation. So I think for me, it was good. Obviously, I'm recovering now. So next year, I'm hoping to PB by quite a bit. And then obviously PB from there and hopefully do some Europeans and some Worlds. And then for the big one in three years. So I'm on track.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Great attitude on injury. I guess all athletes have to have a good approach and philosophy around it because injury is just one of those things that do happen. It sounds like you're very well grounded. By the way, so that really strikes me. I honestly can't, you don't come across as an 18-year-old in my book. At any rate. So on top of all this training, you're also doing you're doing your A levels, and for those, I have listeners outside of the UK, but A levels are like the courses you do that determine whether or not you get into university.
Yes.
Right. They're a big deal here. So you're doing 4 A levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the A levels you're doing?
So I'm doing philosophy, mm-hmm. politics, maths, and PE, physical education.
Yeah. Why? So I can understand the PE. maths, important. Philosophy and politics. That's interesting.
It is.
Why did you choose the?
I've always been fascinated by structure, belief, and why things are the way they are.
Mm.
Whether that's externally and internally. I was dabbling with philosophy for quite a lot, reading quite a few books on the topic, and I was actually very disappointed when I started the course because philosophy is a topic about breaking out of the norms of thinking and acting and actually questioning the structure of reality and the structure of what we, deem as moral or whatever. And the fact that, the education system structures that and it's like, okay, just memorize this bunch of stuff,
take the fun out of it.
Yeah, I'm like, sir, can we at least discuss, Plato's view on this? It's like, no, just revise it for the exam. So that really disappointed me. But I think you really have to question existence and question purpose.
What are some of the philosophers you take to that you...
So I'd say I'm more of like an Eastern philosopher, but I really love Western philosophers. I love Descartes, he literally goes to the base of things. It's like, I think, therefore I am. It's like, that's the beginning of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because in relation to what's around you, the I is what defines things.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to start there. I love, again, Socrates, who is like, just ask questions, I'll ask why, most recently I really like David Silver, is it?
David Silver.
Yeah, on YouTube.
Yeah, I'm not a, I know of him, but I can't profess to know very much about him. But.
So he really talks about this merging of, I think one of your guests talked about it as well, but transhumanism. And
that was my last episode,
your
transhumanism.
Last episode,
yeah.
And that, I've got a lot to say about that for my vision.
Well, I want to get into that, actually. I was thinking about that.
I really enjoy modern philosophy as well, about, you know, how humanity and consciousness and technology are really evolving.
Yes. I think there's, interesting comments about the education system. And, you're going to get through the A-levels, but I would, I would say continue on just thinking not just about getting that piece of paper, but the substance, right? Because that's what you're going to remember.
Absolutely.
You're not going to remember the thing that you memorized necessarily, but these things are going to the things that you remember from school. So I've been several years right from where you were, but the things for me were specific books, specific passages. It's never the test or that kind of thing. Let's talk about technology a little bit. I had a guest the other last week, this episode on transhumanism, which is the use of technology to further further human development, which is a really interesting field. And I would have thought some of the things I've heard about, I would have thought you would you'd have a view on in terms of whether or not if there's a technology that can help you see better. Strikes me as a very good thing.
I was actually, apparently they've been looking for me for months, but they're actually doing this trial on my eye condition at Moorfield Hospital, and it's a 3-stage process. I might just do the first process for now, but it goes like this. First, it's gene therapy. So the gene that's actually causing my vision to get worse is sort of like a virus. So it's about getting another virus, taking the infective part of the virus out, so just keeping the shell,
okay,
and then implanting that cell into the eye, and that captures the faulty gene, and it destroys it, and then your immune system destroys it. So in a sense, that stops your eyes from getting worse. And then the second step is stem cells, which obviously repairs damaged tissues, and we're helping eyes as well. And then the third stage, which I'm really excited about, is a robotic eye.
Wow.
So that's the stage where obviously you've got, I think a camera lens or something, and that attaches to the photoreceptors, and then that kind of goes to your optic nerves, and then it kind of, you see obviously what's around you.
Wow.
So I'm really, obviously, if I didn't have my vision, I'd have doubts, but because it's like, it would help me in a sense, and I think desperation, when people are desperate, they kind of throw morals out the window. So I'm kind of like, let's kind of speed up the process, guys. But
you sound to me like a, and this is a show about risk.
Yeah.
A risk taker. Someone who who's not risk averse.
Yeah.
So you'd be willing to submit yourself to some research and a little bit of experimentation on something like that?
Yeah, provided it's provided there's kind of clear results.
You'd have to understand what you're getting into, obviously.
But I think for me, there's a fine line between risks and sacrifice. I've actually realized I haven't talked a lot about risk even though that's what it's about.
All through it. I'm very keen to get your views on risk and uncertainty, and I think everything that you've done to me suggests that. I actually shouldn't say risk taker. Necessarily in that way, because to me, and I've said this so many times on the show, that risk taking is not recklessness. It's it's being informed, and understanding the uncertainty. But in so doing, diving in and being prepared to to accept some disappointment. That to me is risk taking. It's not gambling. It's not being reckless. But let's talk a little bit about your views on risk taking and uncertainty and that kind of that kind of thing. How do you approach a risk?
I think risk is necessary for evolution. Everything I'm doing, I think I'm taking a big risk. And this is where again I mean there's a fine line between risks and sacrifice because of my training. I'm taking a big risk in my time and my efforts and my money and you know, the time I could be spending with other people, but I'm actually training, that's a huge risk. Is it going to pay off in the end? I could get injured and everything's over. I might not, I really don't want to say this to jinx it, but I might not win a gold medal, even though I really believe I can, you know, in the future. And yeah, I think risk. We all take risks every single second. You know, the risks I've taken with the choices I've made in A-levels, you know, are they really the right, you know, courses for me? I don't know. Yeah. It's a funny...
yeah, you make some interesting points there. I think, you know, a couple of things is I've talked about this before, but it sounds to me like you're very much on the right lines, is that the zone of regret versus the zone of disappointment. I've talked about this on the show before, which is... The zone of disappointment is, well, I've taken a risk. It might not work out, but you know, I'm disappointed. But I knew, you know, I knew that that was the risk, and you know, I'm happy to have taken the risk. Versus the zone of regret being, you know, I should have tried. I don't know. I'll never know.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, regret kind of sticks with you, and disappointment you can learn from. So there's a, you know, there's positivity in being mindful of what the risk is and accepting it.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason why I really love your podcast, because risk is like this really intriguing topic in society that not a lot of people talk about. It's the foundation of everything that's become. It's what doctors, when they're doing like a new trial, it's what entrepreneurs, it's what students, it's what everybody that's, you know, setting out to do something, it's that risk is the foundation, you know, that determines, you know, whether it succeeds or fails.
Yeah.
So it's such a juicy topic, and it covers almost everything.
It is, and you know, philosophically as well, because if you take the, you know, everything has got, at the core of risk is just uncertainty. We don't know if it will or not work out. And sometimes we know how uncertain that is, what the probability is. Sometimes we don't, but everything has got uncertainty. How dull would the world be if everything was certain, right? So, you know, everything is has got some uncertainty to it, so we should become comfortable with it. We should be embracing it. We should be studying it. We should play with it. We should, you know, all of that kind of stuff. That's how to, I think, to live life well and successfully, and it sounds to me like you're doing that. It's interesting from a philosophical perspective. I really love that you're studying philosophy, by the way. It's how boring the way of doing it at A-levels might
absolutely
be, but you know, philosophy is very, very important, because you get philosophical about risk.
Exactly.
About politics, are you studying that as well?
Yeah, politics as well. Actually, back to philosophy, have you read the book Sophie's World?
I have, yes.
Yeah, that's the one I've just
finished.
A long
time ago, so it's a great book. Yeah.
But anyway,
Yeah.
Again, politics, I think it's something I really want to pursue in the future. I think if you really want to impact something, legislation is the biggest thing that's going to, you know, allow it to do that. And I feel like there's so much I want to do, but it's going to be hard to do it without being in politics. So I don't know how I'm going to do that or
I studied politics as well. When I was probably when about your age, I thought it would be great to go into politics and become a politician, in fact. And now I realize that I didn't, because that wouldn't have been a great existence.
The landscape has just been completely shattered.
Even if it hadn't been, you know, politics as a profession, I think there are good people in the world of politics, but I think there are also people that are maybe not the right people for it.
Yeah.
But politics, you can't get away from. It's one of these.
Not at all.
Everything's political, and given the events of recent events here in the UK and the US, and I think it's very important that people stay engaged and aware of politics. I've recently seen a few posts on social media about you should not listen to the news because it's, you know, whatever, depressing, it saps energy, and I think there's some truth to that, but I think thoughtful understanding of the world in which we live and why it's that way. Mm. And that's very important. I think everyone should have a level of, you know, just basic understanding of how to, you know, how the world, you know, of politics and economics, I think, works.
Yeah.
What to do about it, really complicated. Yeah, and is that more UK politics, international politics that you're studying?
What interests I mean, you in that? We do both. First year is UK, second year is American, actually.
Yeah.
But I prefer kind of the whole landscape of things, because originally I actually chose philosophy, politics, economics, and psychology, because I wanted to see how everything merges.
Right.
How the political laws and legislation fits in with economics of the world and trade and industry, and how that fits in with humans and their psychology and what, you know, makes someone buy something or do something, or and then how that fits in with the philosophical questioning of existence itself. So as you can see, like, those four fit in really well in just a general narrative sense, but when it comes to education it really isn't that fun. For me, I wanted to literally understand how everything works from top to bottom, from physical to esoteric.
Yes.
But it really wasn't that, so I changed it.
No, that's really interesting. Beyond Tokyo 2020, in terms of you know, what you'd some of your ambitions, what are they?
I'm very ambitious, but I don't know what to do with it. that's my biggest dilemma. But I think, obviously, I want to win a gold medal at the Paralympics. Yeah. And then I really want to do something in business as well. And this is where I'm currently starting to develop that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized with my athletics, you can think big, but you have to start small.
Mm-hmm.
So originally in athletics, I just went as a hobby, you know, and slowly but surely I did develop and did get stronger to winning a gold medal at the school games. So I kind of realized it's the same formula for everything you want to do. And so with business, I kind of said, you know what, if I keep at this for a couple of years, something could go right. Yeah. So, you know, I've recently started developing a sports initiative called Sporting Vision, might rebrand soon. So this is taking sport as a foundation to improve the lives of people, mainly young people. So it's in three stages. One's how sport can benefit you as a person. So obviously the physical, mental, social, emotional, psychological benefits of sports themselves, and how it can improve you as a student, and how it can cure two of the biggest problems in our society, which are obesity and depression, because sports really can, you know, do that. Secondly is actually doing physical activities where, you know, you do like a mini Olympics and have like competitions and have fun. And then thirdly is about looking at the careers of sports. In sports, actually, beyond just being an athlete, there's a whole world out there. You could be a journalist, you could be a nutritionist, a psychologist, a coach, an analyst, a media person. So there's so much you can do. And, you know, what I'm currently trying to do is develop a program in which I can sort of deliver to schools and colleges to allow students to see that there's a real path in sports. And again, this is where my entrepreneurial side is like, damn, it's hard. It looks nice on the outside for entrepreneurs that are succeeding, but actually when you're starting and trying to make that business plan and applying for funding and getting grants, it's so hard. And that's why I've realized that you really shouldn't hate on someone with a dream, because you don't know what they're going through.
That's so true. I mean, you know, as they say, anything that's worth you know, worth anything, you know, it requires a huge amount of, I mean, it comes back to hard work. Nothing's ever sort of given to anyone, but at the same time, it sounds like, you know, a very wonderful experience to just see how that goes. Sounds like a great great project to try. But entrepreneurialism is that's why a lot of most people don't do it.
It's hard.
but rewarding, I think.
Absolutely,
but there's a lot of ways to be entrepreneurial. It's not just starting a business, where that's the one thing or whatever. There's lots of ways to do it, I think. Be interesting to you talked a few about a few of your the people that inspire you in terms of you mentioned Muhammad Ali, David Beckham, and Conor McGregor. Others, who or what inspires you?
I think what I'm really obsessed with currently is about people that have really found their truth. That's actually quite a broad thing to say.
That's a cool thing to say.
I think there's like a place of such authenticity and such creativity and such, I use this word lightly, but godliness. And there are some people, you know, in the past and maybe currently have got to that place, and I really admire like that place of being and acting. You know, it's the place where, you know, Jesus was, Buddha, the greatest, you know, Michael Jordan, some of the greatest sports people that ever lived, some of the best business people that lived. It's this place of flow. It's this place of, you know, the zone. And I'm really obsessed with, like, what is that? So, obviously, Conor McGregor, he talks a lot about, you know, how he, you know, the reason why he's so successful in the UFC. It's his belief and his constant place in, you know, constant. It's hard to say, but I feel like it's achievable, you know, and it's possible. I don't know what your point of, you know, what your view is on the flow state and all that kind of stuff.
I think the flow state is so important. And as I get older, it's, I just come back to, how important it is. And it's so, and it's hard to achieve because there are so many distractions, that, you know, we need to train ourselves to, you know, to find that, to just, when you're totally absorbed in something and the time just, you know, just, either slows down or goes by very quickly if you're, you know, you're writing or you're, you know, yeah, that's the flow state. And that's, what you want to, you know, we want to be in that state as much as possible. But, yeah. And it's, I think, something that can be practiced, but it has to be practiced. And I think we need to understand how social media and all this, we're overstimulated, and we need to find ways to reduce that level of stimulation. So it's going to be more and more difficult for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you are familiar with Simon Sinek.
Simon Sinek.
Yeah,
I haven't though.
Okay, well, I did want to talk about, you're a millennial, so he does talk about millennials.
I think I've seen a clip of it on Facebook where it talks about why millennials is, you know, such a hard place.
Yeah. And one of the things, I'll put a link in the show notes to this, but because I can't quite remember all of it, but it, you know, these people that have grown up on social media, and so they're never truly, a lot of times, you're never truly sort of passionate about a thing. There's always something better. It's the same thing with relationships. You know, people, the worst thing is to get unfriended. People, I'm very interested in your take on this, whether or not this is the case. I think a lot of what he says applies to millennials, but also to the rest of us. But, you know, there's people I never kind of commit to one another in terms of, well, I'm going to meet you, you know, here at 6 o'clock. Well, I will, but if something better comes along, then I won't. I'll back out. And that just sort of, and what he ends up saying is that, you know, these people will go through life saying, you know, that was fine, right? And that's not, you know, that's not really any way to live a life. And that, and I'm paraphrasing this, you know, completely. And he goes, you know, he says it's not the millennials' fault, and he's generalizing, obviously, but there's, you know, a large people in a certain generation that, you know, have moved into, I guess, a very tough job market and have had different things when they were raised that contribute to this. Paraphrasing him.
I've seen that, yeah.
But I'm interested in your take on all this, because you don't, everything that you've told me here strikes me as someone who, very much is aware, very much is mindful hard work, of things like the flow state, of being committed, this whole thing about, you know, tunnel vision, and you know, there's some very positive things about being totally absorbed in something. So you don't fit the mold of what I've heard Simon Sinek say for a millennial, but that's my take. Curious what you think of that, because I don't know, what are your friends, you know, do you know people that are your friends a bit like that, or I mean, what's, I don't know, this is sort of intergenerational conversation I'm trying to have here. I spoke to a millennial today and
wow, I mean, it's, at the end of the day, it's all a journey of individuality and self-discovery. And it's about, are you presented with the option, are you presented with the mirror? I was presented with the mirror from a very young age.
What do you mean by that?
The questioning of who you are and the part you play in this world. Moving from a country. I say I started at the bottom, but I literally started at the bottom of, you know, poverty of the world, you know, of, you know, disease and whatever. And, you know, I'm slowly moving up. My vision, having a disability, having that extra hardship, I've really had to look at the mirror very hard and question, you know, what is this? And I think for a lot of millennials, my friends, you kind of get carried in this wave, mainly of social media, of trends, of what people are saying and doing, of what, of being, of conformity. And it's really about either stepping back and questioning your individuality and what you have to offer, or it's about fitting into the narrative. And I think a lot of people feel more comfortable to fit into the narrative and avoid the judgment and the difference and the standing out and being the bright colour. But I thrive off that. You know, I think, don't be ashamed to be a bright colour. You know, if you have something to give and something to offer, which is hard to find initially, but when you find it, you know, the journey's worthwhile. If you can stomach the journey, there is a goal, there is gold at the, you know, at the end of the rainbow. So for millennials, Simon this cynic is correct in saying that it's not their fault. You know, they've been presented with the with a world where everything's already done for them. Social media is there. Their parents, you know, grow them up to say, "Oh, you're wonderful. You can do whatever." And then being hit hard with reality, with, you know, university, with jobs, with housing. But for me, those hardships are like, you know, like, you know, I've lived in Africa. You know, I'm blind. What else could be hard? You know, so it's really about perspective and seeing what's, you know, what's really difficult and what you can face in resilience.
That's that's awesome. I mean, I think a very good point about resilience. A very good point about, you know, adversity, right? The moments that are difficult are the moments that shape you. So putting yourself in those situations, sometimes you have to, if they're not presented to you, then you I suppose have to go out and find them, because that's what allows for growth. But it is it's we live in an interesting time. I do wish more the millennials are going to be taking care of me when I'm, you know, old and you know,
more like bots and droids.
maybe so, you know, we need to get this right. We need to help each other. But you know, you're not the stereotypical millennial by any stretch. It is
really goes back to influence as well. You know, social structure. Are you being influenced positively or negatively? And this is why I don't have a lot of friends, because I've realized that the people around you really affect you subconsciously, the way you speak, the way you act, you know, your goals, your aspirations, who you are as a person. I think there's a common phrase that goes around, you are some of the five most
people you hang around with.
I found that to be very true in my life, so I try to kind of influence myself and read my own books and you know, develop my own ideas as opposed to allowing other people. So it's really about being aware of, you know, where your influences are coming from.
That's important. I mean, I've had I think it extends beyond just the people as well, but it's also the, you know, the information you consume, the books you read, the podcasts you listen to, the, you know, all of that kind of stuff. The more that you take in, the more that influences all these little things subconsciously. Yeah. You start to make connections that you didn't know were there. I mean, it's a very, you know, we touched on resilience there. So it's very interesting that you kind of, what is your view on bouncing back from adversity? Yeah. What is, you know, how?
I think it's an opportunity to level up.
Mm-hmm.
And you could either see it as that or just see it as a struggle.
Mm.
I'm actually developing, working on this 6-week, because I told you what, I did psychology, yes, but I dropped it because I didn't like it. And now if I presented me with an opportunity saying, well, you don't like the theory, do you want to do a practical psychology? Like, yes! Uh-huh. They're like, there's an educational psychologist that's working on a 6-week program to help kids transferring from primary school to high school to develop resilience. And, you know, because you're an athlete and you have a lot of resilience, do you want to help develop the program and do it as well? I was like, yeah, why not? So you really see like the elements of resilience, things like perspective, things like comparison, things like the meaning of something. And it's about realizing that your voice, your internal voice has so much power in your emotions and in your actions, because if you have the right thoughts, they will translate into positive feelings and positive actions. And if you have the wrong thoughts, they will, you know, do the opposite. So I think for me, resilience is having the strength to have the right thoughts during those tough times, you know, because it could either break you or make you. It's perspective. It's a hard topic to talk about because there's so much there, trying to find the right words to.
Yeah, no, it's and sometimes these are things that you have to experience as well. It's hard to just talk about it, but I think, you know, I can definitely tell you're on a very good track. I can, you know, tell that you're you know, I also don't want to jinx you, but I think, you know, it sounds to me like you've got all the tools and the perspectives and the things to succeed in a variety of ways. And that also comes back to success. Success doesn't necessarily just mean a gold medal. Whether you get it or whether you don't, doesn't define whether or not, you know, you become a success. But I think your attitude and the way you approach stuff is, you know, just keep going. Like, you're,
thank you.
Yeah, and you know, people should check you out. By the way, where can, I know you've got a YouTube channel, and they should check out your videos. Is that something that you do regularly, your YouTube videos?
I'm trying to do more, but I try to do as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough with A-levels and training.
It
and
is, exactly. But, time is annoying.
Yeah, it's a great chat. What's the, if the people just look for Suleiman Ba?
Yeah, so on social media, Instagram and Twitter, it's KingSoulGB.
Okay.
Or you can just search Suleiman Ba, which I think my name is going to be in the show notes. So, yeah.
Cool. Okay, so I'll put all the links in there. I know we covered a lot of ground. I did have one final question for you, which is when you do win the gold medal in Tokyo, what's the celebration going to be?
Oh,
like?
Come on. I got that question on the BBC.
I loved it, so I had to repeat it.
Wow. I think at the time I said I was going to do the King Solomon, wasn't I, with the crown on the head.
Yeah.
But I think this is wild, but I'm actually going to get someone to stand at the finish line with a golden crown and a gown and a sword.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is when I cross the line and win, I'm going to wear it and just walk around the track just knighting people. Yeah. Is that quite wacky?
That's cool.
Because my name is Solomon. Yeah, it's King Solomon. I'm going to walk around and just act like a king. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see.
That would definitely be memorable. Cool. Yeah. Well, we covered a lot of ground. Was there anything that you wanted to mention that we didn't get a chance to?
I mean, there's so much, but obviously, I don't know. Really, I think we've covered a lot. To be honest,
we did. Yeah. Well, you know, I thought this was a great conversation, and yeah, there's obviously a lot that we can come back and cover. But you know, if that's the case, maybe you can come back on the show, and we can pick up where the conversation left off.
Absolutely.
So Solomon, thank you very much for joining me today.
This was great, a lot of fun.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And I love the podcast. You know, I think what you're doing is so fantastic. It's not a generic podcast where just people talk about crap. It's literally about real world issues real lives of real people and how they're living and adapting their world in a more positive way, and people listening to that, and that's helping people and it's spreading positivity. So I love what you're doing. Keep it up.
In a couple of years,
you're going to be on top of the world.
Thank you, Solomon. And, you know, same here. You know, you're on the track, you're on the path, my friend. Mm. So all the best, and you know, really look forward to following you and wish you the best of luck, but keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. Solomon is someone that makes me feel quite confident that the future is in pretty good hands. So remember the name Solomon Baugh, you might be hearing it again. Check out the show notes, the links to where to find him and all of the things that we talked about. They're all there as usual. If you have any feedback on the show, allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to provide that. Once again, check out allthingsrisk.co.uk to find all the places through which you can find the show. We're going to end it here right now. We'll be back soon. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.